everyone, and welcome to Total Football Debate, episode 39. It's three of us. We've got Cossie and Jace here today. How are you, boys?
Evening.
Yeah, all good.
So let's get straight into it. No time wasted.
Oh, wait, hang on.
A bit to talk about. Uh-oh.
Hang on. Did you hear that? Oh, did you not hear that? The fireworks have just gone off up in the dales of Yorkshire for Bielsa. There's a bit of a South American shindig going on there. Ah, did you hear it? The Messiah has landed somewhere over in the Yorkshire.
I'm too emotional. I can't talk. I'm too emotional. I haven't slept since. I've cried every day. The man, the legend. I'm speechless. I can't contain my emotions. The best coach in the world by far. He gets absolutely rightly praised by every single pundit, saying at least they're going for it still. 5-0 down, yeah, they're still going for it. 6-0, yeah, credit to Bielsa after a 6-0 defeat. Superb. Their team showed so much ambition, attacking. They looked brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Though they may have lost 6-0, superb. There's not a better 6-0 ever. For any manager to lose 6-0, it's heartbreaking that it's gone. I'm gutted.
Hey, tribute. I took one of my calls earlier and sat on the toilet for him whilst talking to my client because it just seemed the right thing to do. You know, if I wanted to get success out of that client that I took the call for, I just felt I had to sit on something. We just need to remember him and remember what he did for sport.
If we can have a moment's silence, please, that would be much appreciated. As I say, I'm still wiping the tears away.
Starting from now.
Thank you.
Thought Maradona passing was bad, that Bielsa's sacking is next level. I mean, what's that translator going to do now, poor guy?
Do you know what? In all seriousness, I'm actually going to quite miss that guy. I don't know about you guys. This is not me taking the piss either. I think he's brilliant. It's almost like he knows he's taking the piss out of Bielsa at the same time, thinking that this guy's a bit weird, isn't he? And then whatever he's saying.
Maybe he can translate what a good coach looks like and what good looks like. Maybe he can unmuddle it all for us. Or maybe he'll just end up at the job centre in Leeds City Centre with the rest of them.
The thing is, when it comes to Leeds' defence, maybe he just wasn't translating it correctly. Maybe
that's what I'm hoping for. That's what I'm hoping for. Bantering. In 20 years' time, he's going to release a book in which he reveals that he never translated Bielsa's tactics across to the players correctly.
Keep it tight at the back, lads. Honestly, just keep it solid. Yeah, do whatever the fuck you want, boys. Just go and attack.
See how many keepy uppers you can do. Well, we're on topic because I was going to, funny enough, start with Leeds because it made sense. You know, I feel like since TFD started, all the managers we love to talk about are going. You know, who do we talk about now? Who's the next victim? Lampard, I'd imagine.
Brendan Rodgers.
Beat me to it. Brendan Rodgers and Lampard beat me.
Yeah, I'm happy with them too. They are the new Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Marco Bielsa. Because we called them both way before the media got on Bielsa's back, that's for sure. We were one of the first sort of little outlets to say, what is all the hype around Bielsa? And funny enough, it clocked on and within 2 weeks, he's gone. Anyway, they did play. Well, they tried. Liverpool 6-0 and lost at home to Tottenham 4-0. Remember, we're talking about this from a Leeds perspective because we will move on to the other teams. So,
talking about it from a Leeds perspective, yeah?
In one word.
Yeah. Oh, we were so good against Liverpool. I mean, we tried really hard. We had so many shots at goal, but, you know...
In all fairness to Leeds, I'm looking at the stats. They had... Liverpool only had one offside and Leeds had six. So that's full credit to Leeds.
And they did beat Liverpool 13-10 on throw-ins. So, you know, I think we're being a bit harsh.
I've just come across another stat as well. Goalkeeper saves. Alisson only made two. Rubbish. Goalkeeper saves for Leeds, 9. Top that. Top that, lads.
The fire. Christ. Oh, dear. What happens now? Obviously, with their new manager, they've appointed one.
Same again. At Leipzig, he was awful for 3 months. Because the Leeds fans don't care. As long as they concede and they try, it's all good. I mean, in all seriousness, what Leeds will soon uncover is what I think most of us gathered in the first season, where they finished pretty strongly, is that Bielsa, in that first season in the Premier League, I don't buy the championship bollocks, because everyone worships him saying, oh, he got us out of the championship. Well, with the players they had, it was about the 10th time of asking. Of course they should have got out of the championship. So, green tick there. The reality is, they went up, and in that first season where he overachieved with a team that is no better than, for now, mid-table championship. So I think what they'll find with this new manager that comes in is that ultimately what has cost them here is squad development. Now, quite an interesting little snippet, actually, in all seriousness, aside from the Bielsa jokes. There's a guy that I follow on social media that is quite well in within the sports industry, and his take on it is essentially COVID has basically cost Bielsa the chance to develop the team. Now, we mentioned it a few times, I think, in the summer and also in January in terms of the transfer market and why they don't seem to be spending. And supposedly, their plans in the summer got absolutely ransacked due to the financial losses that are obviously accelerated because of things like COVID. So he was quite empathetic from a Bielsa perspective, in that really changed the kind of mindset and how they went going forward. However, on the flip side, what he did mention, which I thought was an intriguing point, if you're a coach of that team and you know your transfer budget has been obliterated, you then need to find a way to adapt to a plan B in order to get the best out of those players that you have at your disposal. And I think we mentioned it in the last podcast over the last few weeks, is that that's Bielsa's downfall. He's got one way of playing, which is brilliant on some days, which is great when you've got a fully fit squad and your best players available. However, when you get injuries or you don't have the depth to do it every week, you will get found out. And especially in the Premier League, I know may come across as biased, but playing that style every week in the French League, for example, is completely different to playing it in the Premier League every week, because in the Premier League, you are challenged every single week. No disrespect to the French League or La Liga, but, you know, aside from kind of when he was, you know, with Bilbao, maybe Atletico, Barca, Real Madrid and Sevilla, aside from that, yeah, his style would have served them well because the teams around them are medical. But in the Premier League, it's a very tough ask. Klopp found this out when Klopp first joined Liverpool. You remember the squad that he inherited there, but Klopp found a way to adapt. Well, actually, they addressed it in the transfer market, essentially. But again, he adapted through the transition period. And with Bielsa, what he's not been able to do, where they were due to go for an evolution in the transfer market and they haven't been able to, he hasn't adapted to get the best out of the squad.
And also with Klopp, he improved certain players and then sold them for the highest market value possible with a clever sporting director and everyone else behind the scenes. But I know we're comparing the two. However, that's the difference between the genius managers who come in, well, I play rock and roll football. It doesn't always work, mate. So obviously you adapt to the conditions that you're working under. Whereas it's just one dimensional, even though he finished third in the world coaches of the best ever in the history of football, which is obviously a bunch of bollocks. But the best coaches, regardless of budget, they know how to get the best out of the players and the systems that they play.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's not a lot to say about Leeds in terms of the two games. It's a bit irrelevant now. Bielsa's gone. We need to see what the new Leeds are, if anything. You know, it was a downhill trajectory. There's no point covering that. The new manager, I don't know whether there's an expectation for him to keep Leeds up here. The way their team's lining up, other than Rafinha, I mean, I look at the team that they start with, and to be honest, it doesn't give me any kind of reassurance unless they've managed to get back Bamford, Phillips, etc. but that doesn't look like that's anytime soon either. So the easiest way to summarise this, and then we move on, is it's going to come down to, with 18th spot, which manager is worse for a few clubs. So we'll see. We'll see. Let's move on to a team that faced Leeds, and let's cover what also we predicted on last week's show and what we brought to life, which was a certain stat around Antonio Conte. Let's just say we called that.
Is the stat that he's just a complete nutcase and, you know, he just needs to stop drinking coffee and just to calm down sometimes.
He needs a chill pill, did he? But we called it. I certainly brought it to life, to keep an eye on. And it came to fruition. Preparing for a midweek game is not his strong point. And lo and behold, they got beaten by Burnley. I said it had to be 6 points if we wanted top four. It wasn't 6 points. I think, to be completely honest, that is it for Spurs. I don't see enough there that ensures consistency required to obtain fourth spot. I know, we win our two games. We're ahead of Man United and West Ham. Unless Arsenal decide to all of a sudden stop playing, I do think it's in their hands. And also, I guess it kind of comes down to how bad Chelsea want to play going forward as well. Because 8 points seems like a lot, but judging by Man City and Liverpool, we know that's not the case.
Chelsea have got a bit of a distraction in the background as well.
Interesting take on that, because I'd actually have you... You mentioned the two games in hand there and the consistency required, but actually I'd argue if you look at Man United and their offensive options, Arsenal and their lack of firepower, seemingly, West Ham and their lack of consistent firepower, I'd actually say out of the pack, out of those three, with Kulusevski, Son, Kane, Lucas... I'd say Spurs are in a bit better position there. It's the defence for me, I think, and the midfield. If you can sort that out.
I mean, just to kind of bring it to life, I mean, I've looked at 5 games. I've looked at 10 games in form. And in both 5 and 10 games, Spurs are behind West Ham, Arsenal and Man United. So, unfortunately, regardless of who we have, it's clear to see that, Spurs are on the same level of form as Palace in the last 5 games, which kind of brings that to life. And, we're behind West Ham, Chelsea, Wolves, Man United, Arsenal in 10 games. So I don't know. I just haven't seen enough consistency in the last 10 games that make me think, even though on points total, We're not out of sight. I just can't see it happening unless Arsenal decide to go on an absolute bender, which we know is possible. So, to be honest, we'll talk about Burnley because they're the next team that are coming up in a moment. And that's when we'll highlight the game between Burnley and Spurs, because then we can talk from both perspectives. The Leeds game, credit where it's due. Some of the goals that Spurs scored were incredible. And officially,
that song goal had me on my feet, honestly.
Officially, they are now the number one duo in Premier League history. I mean, are we saying Kane's the best passer of the ball in the Premier League at the moment?
You say that they're number one duo. What have they won?
Exactly my point.
To be fair, I know you've covered this. It was just me saying, "What number one? Number one in what?" I was just fishing. But at the minute, Kane is looking. At the start of the season, his head was down, and obviously the whole Man City thing. However, Conte just seems to... He's hungry again, isn't he? He wants to be that number one man again. And his work rate, his passing, unbelievable.
One of the things that... We've never spoken about this, I don't think, as a podcast collective, when we speak of Spurs. Someone tweeted something on Saturday, and it really stood out for me. And I don't think anyone... Even in the media, I don't think anyone even in the media has really spoken about him in this term. Son either must be the most underrated player in the Premier League, or genuinely, whoever he deals with, like in terms of his agent, Nothing ever gets leaked. There's never stories linking him with a move away. There's never news about him wanting a new contract or seeking a move. I just can't believe that there is no club around Europe that has ever, ever... Harry Kane, and rightfully so because of his record historically, is always the one that gets linked. It baffles me to this day. And I saw someone say, oh, maybe it's because the thought of negotiating with Levy is just an automatic put off. But then Harry Kane is up there and that was big money and that could have been a nightmare. But I don't understand how Son has never, ever, ever been linked with a move away to a, no disrespect to Spurs here, but a top club. I think he'd fit Klopp's system brilliantly. Not that they need him, but he's an option. City, I think he could do a job at City. Better than Grealish.
No one's better than Grealish, mate. Worth every penny.
Chelsea, Barca, like, it astounds me. It absolutely astounds me. And also for the fact that his profile, what he could bring from a marketing perspective in terms of, you know, influence into, you know, wider markets in terms of Asia and, you know, pre-season tours and all that kind of stuff that comes with that, similarly to kind of Park Ji-sung at United. I can't believe that he's not... But then, you know, is that a player thing? Is it, you know, because even when Ji-sung Park was at United, he was one of the most underrated players in Europe at one point, but no one ever really was linked with him. I don't know, it's a weird one, but just, I could not believe not one club in Europe has even attempted to bid for him.
He's like the Elvis of South Korea, isn't he? He's so unbelievably popular in the Asian continent. However, in Europe, he's not that fashionable guy that you sort of see like with the bling. You don't see him with a sort of like, you know, fancy cars. He's very disciplined. He's very humble. He's very smiley. He's not sort of like, he's like your best friend, isn't he? He's sort of that like, oh, he's lovely, isn't he?
I don't think you probably pick up on this unless you've got Son in your team. But I would argue that Heung-min Son is the most popular Spurs player of all our squad. Reason being, when I've gone to games, the South Koreans come in their numbers to Spurs now. Like, and again, I don't know if you've ever known this because of, you know, pop culture and stuff. Son has this following that if you've ever seen BTS or heard of BTS, he's got this sort of mass following that's borderline psychotic. There's this like new kind of thing where, and it's weird to say this, but Korean culture has just blown up. Since this BTS have come on the scene, it seems like now all of a sudden, I mean, you only have to look them up and see they're the biggest band in the world. Son's got a similar follow. It's weird. It's really weird. So I'd actually argue for a club that would do wonders for their image. But the thing that I've heard with Son is the type of person he is, because he shut down any chance of him moving before he even needed to. He was like, no, I'm staying. I want to stay with Spurs, et cetera, et cetera. He signed a new contract. Happy day. His agents, I mean, when you look at who his agent is, that agent has got players there that do ask for moves. You know, his agent is the same as James Maddison, same as Wilf Zahar, same as Dele Alli. So he's got an agent that likes to put his players out there. But the one thing that Song does, and this, I think it does come down to the type of players, because I don't know if you've ever seen that interview that went viral where he said he won't marry anyone until his football career is over because he don't want any distractions. So I think he's just, and a lot of people hate him for being this guy that's apparently Mr. Nice. They hate him. They always post like laughing images of him crying and stuff because they think he's got this he's got this snarly attitude about him since he done that tackle on Gomez. And then he done that kick out on the Chelsea player as well. And they were like, oh, Mr. Nice Guy Son. And some people hate him for some reason. It's really odd fan base, but yeah, I don't know what it is, but you're right, Jace. I mean, I'd argue that, you know, they compare him to Mane all the time as like back and forward, and Mane's got the credentials behind him. But I'd love to know if it was the other way around. I mean, you couldn't say Son wouldn't have the credentials. If you took Mane out right now, Son would plug that gap immediately.
I've heard that off the field he's a gen. It just astounded me that, you know, because he never gets spoken about in the same light as Harry Kane. For me, he's the most underrated player in the Premier League.
Let's move on then. Let's go to a team that deserve a lot of praise for how they are once again fighting to stay up. Here they are after, what, five games, and they're seventh in the form table. Burnley. Are they staying up?
100%.
Jason has seen it firsthand. So, I mean, I'll just say from the Spurs point of view, don't get me wrong, I'd be kidding myself if I said Burnley didn't catch us on a bad day. But that's not their fault. They need to do what they have to do. They deserve to win. In the end, I didn't see anything from us that says otherwise. They just look well organised. They just look solid at the back. Weghorst, that guy.
He looks quality. Very good.
He's absolutely quality. And I don't know whether Jason saw anything in their game against Palace that signaled that. But I think at the moment, bearing in mind they've still got two games in hand over Leeds, three over Brentford, I can't see them going down.
I can't.
Not a chance.
They were. It was quite funny. The game at Palace was. It was literally. It was very much costly, actually, like the Norwich game. It was a true game of two halves. We could have been 3 or 4 nil up at half time if we could score more consistently. But everyone said around us, there's no way Burnley are going to be that bad again in the second half. There's no way Sean Dyche allows them to get away with that. And lo and behold, they came out in the second half and they scored after, I mean, it was ridiculous. We'll go on to that later from a Palace perspective. They scored after 30 seconds in the second half. But then after they did that, they were back to their best. They were pressing, suffocated us off the ball. Weghorst was running into back into midfield to put the pressure on, and you know they're not going down.
Can I just give a massive shout out for Aaron Lennon, how he has reinvigorated himself out of nowhere. That guy looks like he's turned back the clock like 10 years. Like I was watching him get down that wing against Palace in the highlights. He just looked like he was causing problems.
No one saw that coming.
Not at all. I mean, Everton, I can't even believe he was at Everton before Burnley. I mean, what a change of form.
He's 35.
I know. He looks like he's 25. Ben Mee has come out of nowhere and elevated himself. I mean, Brownhill's come in and just done a job. I mean, McNeil looks reinvigorated as well. Rodriguez looks like he's kind of flipping back the switch, which is...
That offside was harsh. Like, you know, like... You can't argue with it because it's VAR, those shitty little lines, etc. But you watch that back in real time, you think, surely he's not offside. And that would have been a hell of a goal as well. I think everyone in the stadium thought it was a goal. And you watch a replay and you think that's a goal. And then you watch the freeze frame and you think, oh, fuck's sake. But that would have been a superb goal as well.
So, massive shout out to Burnley. They deserve a hell of a lot of credit. And I mean, how long until Sean Dyche deserves to get some kind of like...
Why did we rule out Sean Dyche, of all people? I know that they had several games in hand and everyone was like, oh, but they're playing crap. They're this, they're that. No chance. And then all of a sudden, Sean Dyche like pulls up his trousers, wears a shirt in the snow. And all of a sudden, it's like, right, it's my turn now, lads. And he's absolutely nailed it.
Well, I actually think, when you think about it like this, they brought Cornet in, didn't they? Who they've needed a player like that for ages. We said that in the summer podcast about transfers. When you look at the teams at the bottom, it's always those that have that one player that can make something out of nothing. And that's where I think, to a point, Norwich are missing something that can...
Norwich are the only team left from who we originally mentioned that don't have that one player. And Burnley got it with Cornet, and that has just changed their whole...
And not just that, what I will say... And maybe this is a bit clever of Burnley, playing the whole public PR, oh, we're fuming that we have to get rid of him. But you're not telling me that low-key in the boardroom as a manager, you're sitting there thinking, we sold Chris Wood for £25 million and we got Weghorst for, what, 13, 14 million? And he's a massive upgrade on Chris Wood. You look at Chris Wood in Newcastle now. He can't even get a game. Newcastle fans are on his back. You know, he's going to, I said a few weeks ago that he'll be loaned out, he'll be the first one out of the door.
Rolling in, because I am doing this in a particular order on purpose. That now gives you flexibility, Jace, to talk about Palace.
Hey.
You said you wanted 4 points minimum. You got them.
Yep. I mean, look, Vieira's done it again. Every time we speak about Vieira and, ooh, Palace look a bit ropey. Can he turn it round? He's done it. 4 points out of six. I'm not going to lie. I will be greedy and say that I think on Saturday that should have been 3 points. If you look at the first half as a collective, we could have been way out of sight on after the first half. It could have been 3 or 4 nil. Second half, story of our season, really. Keep crucial points in the game, either the last minute or the first minute, or, you know, the first minute of second half. 28 seconds into the second half, I think it was something absurd. Cross comes in. Granted, it's unlucky because it's an own goal. Milivojevic obviously didn't intend to put the ball in the net, but concentration at key points. And once they got that goal, as I said earlier, they were pressing, leading the line. We had a few half chances off the back of that. Zaha hit, I think it was, who hit the post again, and a few nearly moments. Elise, again, standout player. He's going to be some player, it has to be said. I don't think he's with us for more than two seasons. I think his ceiling is absolutely massive. But yeah, bigger picture, 4 points from a possible six, which in the context of where we were and, you know, the kind of ropey results. As I said before, this season wasn't about breaking top 10. It wasn't about anything. It was about surviving. And Vieira's done more than that. And I think that's the third time this season now where everyone's starting to think, ooh, Vieira's Palace are just starting to go off the boil. Can he rein it back in? And look, Watford away, let's not discount that game, but Burnley, the form they're in, that was a tough ask, especially after them beating Spurs. But Watford away, off the back of, you know, their position, and that was a must-win game for them. To come away from that with a 4-1 win. Gallagher again back on form. I mean, I said this before, Kiarte, the return of Kiarte and MacArthur in that midfield, is no coincidence that Gallagher's form has now picked up, because what they offer is protection for him to go forward. And it's no coincidence, if you look at our results between January and up until 2 weeks ago, Kiarte at AFCON, MacArthur out with a hamstring injury long term, that's when the results started to go downhill. So, you know, all things is game on for Palace. Season back on, FA Cup during midweek against Stoke, so maybe a bit of a run to the cup final as well, hopefully. One player I do want to, I've never really spoken about him, but just to wrap this up, the one player that I think is nicely for Palace going under the radar, Tyrick Mitchell. I think he's got a massive, massive future. Now, his ceiling at the moment, defensively, not as impressive as Wan-Bissaka when he came on the scene. But one thing that is different between him and Wan-Bissaka is great at defending, but one thing that has always been criticised of him at Man United is his lack of being able to contribute in the attacking phase. Mitchell, Vieira came in and said, right, you need to add that to your game. And he started to add assists now to his game, and he obviously got the assist against Watford as well. So, you know, he's one to watch, I think.
Moving on nicely, because it rolls into where we have, I mean, typical, isn't it? Watford go and lose 4-1 to Palace and then get a 0-0 draw against Man United. I mean, story of their life. Watford in 19th, is that where they're going to be?
Yes, it's going to be us, Watford and Brentford, to put it frank. Pardon the pun.
We'll get to Brentford because I know you want to talk about them. So, I mean, it's just too up and down for Watford, isn't it? It's just far too... You don't stay up doing that.
So that's where Leeds can consider themselves lucky, because even though they're on the decline, Everton can probably consider themselves lucky because Brentford are just on an absolute free-for-all that we'll get to. But yeah, I can't see Roy keeping Watford up despite the draw against Man United. They were completely outplayed that game. Another day that could have been 4-0 United and no one would have even argued it, but they just couldn't bloody score. And as much as I always love when United don't win, I did have them in my last man standing selection, and Ronaldo hitting the post, and Elanga up front had a great chance and should have scored. It's just one of those things that another day Man United have won that 4-0 and that would have been easy.
The only thing I will say, just to err on the edge of caution, is that is now, after that 0-0 game against United, that is now Hodgson's sixth game in charge. and they've kept three clean sheets and they've got 5 points from those six games. Now, when you bear in mind of those six games, two of them have been against teams in the kind of top four or five, and they beat Aston Villa and they only just lost to West Ham. It took him 7 or 8 games at Palace before we got our first win. Now, I'm just looking ahead to the March fixtures here, but they've got a home game against Arsenal, which you expect Arsenal to win, but I can fully see that being the game where Watford could cause them some problems. They're then away to Wolves, who are inconsistent and a bit blunt at times up top. But then the key bit for me is the end of March, and that is away to Southampton and at home to Everton. Now, Southampton aren't really in that relegation picture at the moment, but they are, at the moment, they're not returning to being the inconsistent team, but at some point, they will level off and probably have a loss in them.
Sorry to interrupt, but what I would say about Southampton, I was going to say this Norwich segment, however this is relevant now, is their home record is third in the league behind Liverpool and Man City, I believe. So going away to Southampton, yes, on paper, it's one of those results where you think, oh, do you know what? You could get a point here. However, looking at their home form, it's actually unbelievable.
But I think the key for Watford, the key is going to be that Everton game on the 20th of March. They get anything from that. I mean, they go into April. If you look further ahead than that, in April, 3 of their 5 games are Leeds, Brentford and Burnley, all of which are at home. So I don't think this is done yet. Because for me, if you look at the table now, if you're asking me who's going to go down, Norwich, yes. Burnley, no. But conceivably, if the Leeds manager doesn't kick them on when he goes in and stop the rot, or if Watford do pick up points against Everton and Brentford, then all of a sudden you're looking at those two. And again, I know Newcastle have got one more game to play, but let's not kid ourselves here. You know, the relegation scrap, you could argue, when you look at 18th, if Burnley win, Burnley still have 2 or 3 games in hand on Brentford and co. and Palace. Leicester sitting there on 27 points. There's only a 6-point gap between 18th and 13th. So I think there's a long way to go yet. The one thing you've got to remember is this. Brentford, you need experience, right, into how to calm the players in this relegation battle. Eddie Howe's got it because he's survived most of it at Bournemouth before he got sacked and then they eventually got relegated. Brentford don't have the experience. Leeds most definitely don't have the experience. Everton don't have the experience to get themselves out of a relegation dogfight. And, well, Leicester, let's face it, they'll pull the trigger before if they even dare get dragged into it. But if you're looking at the teams around you, Hodgson will fancy himself against Lampard, the new Leeds manager, and the Brentford manager. And I wouldn't bet against him either, because it's very hard for people to forget. I know Palace always had the quality, but when he came in at Palace, we were already 4 games without a win. And then we, you know, I think it was then 6 or 7 games before we even got points under Hodgson. So, and that first win came against Chelsea. So never say never. As long as they've got Dennis fit, as long as they've got Josh King fit and all their offensive options, all it takes is 1 or 2 good games.
Do you know what? I think Dean Smith would fancy himself against Lampard and Leeds manager and Brentford if his squad had that little bit of quality that we just said that Watford had. You know, if only Norwich had that one player that could turn a game on its head. Unfortunately, that doesn't appear to be the case. He went to Bournemouth. Lol. Final double team. Bit of a surprise, actually. When it mattered, they crumbled. You know, Arsenal and West Ham, 2 massive games for Wolves, and unfortunately they've established themselves firmly into that mid-table pack, top of the pack, may I add. Just not quite there, are they?
I must admit, I did think that was going to happen, because like I always say, whenever I, like a Norwich supporting idiot that I am, and whenever we look good up against a team like Wolves, get points, it obviously went through against them at the cup, in the cup. I always worried about Wolves, to be honest. And they also could have been 2-0 up in that game against Arsenal quite easily. Obviously, they took the lead, but they had 2 or 3 absolutely golden opportunities to make that 2-0. and they just didn't do it. And the problem with Wolves is if they don't take the lead and maybe get that second goal where they can start to relax, they're always up against it. And against a team like Arsenal at the Emirates, who had just beaten them as well, it was only really going to be one winner after they didn't take the chances to seal that win, really.
One thing I will say is, if you look at Wolves' fixtures, has anyone got a kinder march than Wolves? Palace at home, Watford at home, Everton away, Leeds at home. That is a big march. You know, I mean, other than maybe Palace, could they be looking at minimum 10 points there?
The key will be, as it always been with a story of Wolves this season. You remember at the beginning of the season, they kept drawing games.
And scoring the goals.
They'll come good because they'll score. West Ham, Fabio Silva, he came with all the plaudits of being this wonder kid. I'm not seeing it. How much did they sign him for?
35 million quid. And I was going to get onto that because I was ready to absolutely slate him. However, I did watch highlights, obviously, on Match of the Day. And the service to him on the Sunday game was absolutely atrocious. However, he's shown literally nothing since he's been at Wolves. You can analyse it as much as you want and see about the lack of creativity around him, the lack of movement, the lack of this, lack of support, etc. But he's shown nothing. Who spends 35 million quid? He's been there, what, in 18 months? So obviously he would have been
17 years old. He was when they spent 35.
Jesus. Obviously Portuguese owners, Portuguese Mendes, Portuguese, well, from the looks of it, corruption, spending £35 million on him. Jesus Christ.
Now, look, it's been the story of all season, and that's been the difference between them breaking into Europe and actually where they are now, where they'll find themselves at the end of the season, because they just can't find a way to score. And... well, he made five changes in that game on Sunday, didn't he, against West Ham to freshen it up, and it just didn't work. You know, he had Jimenez on the bench, Podence on the bench. It didn't work. And for all the plaudits that Neves and João Moutinho get in that middle of the park, and, you know, I actually think the thing that undoes the whole of Wolves, and they've lost the element of it now, Adama Traore is at Barca, is... yes, Neves is very good at picking out a ball, and Moutinho are good. They're good at spraying the ball. But what they lack is a bit of dynamism or a bit of mobility just to kind of carry them up the pitch kind of 15, 20, 30 yards. Instead, they were trying to play cute balls into Fabio Silva. I don't know what Fabio Silva is, but he's not a target man. He's clearly not a target man because he doesn't have the, you know, he doesn't have the attributes, shall we say, that's the polite way of putting it, to be a target man. He's not a Jimenez, you know, and it's not as if Jimenez is playing a Harry Kane role where, you know, maybe it could work Fabio Silva if Jimenez played the Harry Kane role and sprayed balls in, but I don't think Jimenez is good enough to play that. The system relies too heavily on wing-backs and João Moutinho and Neves, but again, you lose that mobility. The game against Palace in September, they lost because... they lack mobility in the midfield, and Gallagher and whoever was in the midfield at the time overran them. I think that could be a similar pattern going into the game this weekend. And I just think Bruno Lage, there's nothing wrong with him as a coach, but we said this in the summer about Wolves and the murmurs about the kind of owners being reluctant that they need to sell before they buy. I think they're in a state of flux and limbo come the summer because I don't see the owners spending big money in order to resolve the issues they currently have unless they manage to sell, or they sold Adama Traore, but they're not going to sell Fabio Silva because he's not shown anything. Ruben Neves, they'll probably maybe look to sell him. But aside from that, I don't know, they're just one of those teams for me. They play great football, got great philosophy, but I just think they're missing a couple of players, a bit of dynamism, a bit of... ironically, I never thought I'd say it, but someone like Adama Traore. But Adama Traore with quality, I think, is what they're missing.
Agreed. No, it was two big games. But then again, as we say, you know, they could turn it around if they get a minimum of 10 points in their next few games because it's a kind run. It's just a shame, yeah, they would have hoped that they could have picked something up from that West Ham and Arsenal fixture.
We talked about that relegation battle. The biggest influence in that relegation battle right now is probably going to be Wolves. Because if you look at March, they've got Watford, Everton, and Leeds.
Yep. They've got a lot of the smaller teams at the bottom, funny enough, because they've also got, towards the end of the season, they've got Newcastle and Burnley as well still to play. So, and Brighton, if they're going down, Jace.
Well, we'll finish above them.
Right, that's the first segment done. We come on to predictions in a week, Jace, where if me and you had put an accumulator on, we'd be quids up.
Are you joking? That's really annoyed me. You know why? Because I got a Facebook notification that 10 years ago to the day, on Sunday, was the day I put that accumulator on and I was waiting for that Barcelona result. Do you remember? For £125 from a quid. And they were drawing 1-1 to Malaga.
I mean, you'll be annoyed that you didn't get one correct score, but you got all the outcome. So, Watford Palace, the only person that didn't get a point was you, Koss. You said it would be 2-2, whereas Jason, Cookie and myself all said Palace would get a win, so we all get
that
a point.
Makes a change for me, doesn't it?
That's because
it does.
His mate Putin's been distracted. He can't influence the results.
Yeah, he's got to lose a couple of them. Otherwise, it looks a little bit dodged, doesn't it? I mean, look, it doesn't take a genius to say Liverpool would beat Leeds. However, Cookie will be gutted as he was only one goal off the correct scoreline. He said 5-0. Posse and Jace, you said 4-0. I gave Leeds a bit of credit and said they'd get a goal.
What an idiot I am.
Never going to happen. So, on to the next game, which was Leeds Spurs. Posse, for some reason, along with Cookie, you thought there would be a draw, whereas me and Jace said Tottenham would win 3-1.
I think I was just going by the expected Burnley loss, but
I think you were high, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then Brentford, Newcastle, Posse and Jace, you said it would be 2-1, which gives you both a point, whereas me and Cookie got the correct scoreline. We said it would be 2-0 to Newcastle. So the only score that was correctly identified this week was that one, which gives Cookie 3 points, gives me 3 points. So, tell you what, we talk about the Premier League table being tight. So, joint bottom is Jason Koss on 43, Cookie on 44, I'm on 58. So I am running large. But Jace, next time, put an accumulator on, mate. Christ almighty. That would have got you a nice little... a few away wins in there, Jace. A few away wins in there. Would have got you a few pennies. But never mind. Never mind. No Wheel of Wonder this week. Reason being, double game week. Just keep up with tradition. So what we're going to do is jump straight into the second segment because we've obviously got a particular game we need to discuss because it went on for years. And also there was a lot of comedy in that one. But first, what I'm going to do is say, can we tick off the three teams that we briefly already discussed, but from their perspective? So we've got Arsenal beating Wolves, Man United's draw to Watford, and West Ham also beating Wolves. So just briefly across the three, Arsenal and West Ham first, just because they beat Wolves. I mean, how do you think Arsenal are doing? I mean, they've had the strongest Feb, haven't they?
Well, they've won their last 3 out of 5, and, you know, it's actually 4 out of 5 unbeaten, isn't it? Because they drew one in there as well. So, all things considered, I hammered Arsenal and said that in January, after all their business, I think this is with Kossi, actually, we were discussing it in that transfer podcast. It seemed outrageous that they were just letting Aubameyang go, and all these players go, and they didn't bring any offensive options in to help with the, you know, the absence of the likes of Aubameyang and strikers up top. The test is going to be, and this is why I still think Spurs might edge it, the test is going to be keeping the likes of Saka, Lacazette fit, because all it takes is one or two knocks or injuries, or red card, because they like a red card now and again and surprise us all. And that could throw them off the scent. But in the context of things, that was a big game for them against Wolves and a big result because we all know Wolves aren't easy. And they left it very, very late. But look, 3 points is 3 points. It allows them to build. you know, and when you look at the context of, you know, the rest, you know, West Ham and United around them, when, you know, if you're Arsenal at the minute, I mean, you're talking about them lacking firepower, but United have supposedly got firepower, although they're probably all got their feet up at the care home tonight because of their average age. You fancy them, but again, it just depends on whether or not you can keep it consistent. They've got some potentially tricky games in March, you know, Leicester, Liverpool, and away to Villa. But you never know. They just need to keep the run going. As for West Ham, if you go on to West Ham, big win for them. They needed that win against Wolves. If they didn't get that, I think they would have been getting a bit edgy. But, you know, they've managed to scrape a win again. Despite not investing in a striker in January, they're still surviving and doing what they need to do. And if you're West Ham, and if you're Arsenal, and if you're Spurs, or anyone in that race, you look at that Man United result against Watford and think, Jesus, we've got a chance here. Because they really, really, really are in trouble now, Man United.
Man United's next four games, can I just highlight, in all competitions. So this would be where it comes down to cost, what they prioritise. They've got Man City next, away from home. As Jason just says, they've got Spurs at home. They then have Atletico Madrid, which they obviously didn't do what they needed to do. And then they got Liverpool away. What are four games for Man United? So, I mean, when you look at it like that, you know, what do they target? Because, I mean, they've got to be in cuckoo land if they think they can win the Champions League, but they're obviously going to give it a go, being at home.
Going to the most recent fixture, like the next fixture, for some reason, Man United seem to be Man City's bogey team at the Etihad as well. So, again, you wouldn't be surprised if Man United came up with a really dodgy 1-0 win against City. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen personally. However, you also wouldn't be surprised just because of the history between the two teams. But yeah, going to the Champions League, they didn't do what they needed to do. But they've got a home fixture against Atletico Madrid, and they're not going to win the Champions League. But they must. Well, Ronaldo's thinking that he could probably win it, knowing what his ego's like.
Right. Well, that's those three games ticked off quickly. I just wanted to get them out of the way. Now we can move on. So let's tackle it, shall we? Because Liverpool had two games. Obviously, from a Leeds perspective, we don't really need to discuss that game. They spanked them, game over. Bielsa's gone, happy days. Did what they needed to do. Unless there's anything in that game that was worthy of mentioning, I can't think of anything, really.
I did put a bet on Van Dijk any time, and him scoring in the 93rd minute was quite pointlessly good for me. However, yeah, it's just to get the icing on the cake.
So let's talk about that cup final. One of the greatest 0-0 cup finals you'll probably ever see.
What, one of the best cup finals, I think, in general, regardless of it being 0-0. It's probably one of the best and most entertaining cup finals I've ever watched.
Where do we even start? Do we start with the goals disallowed? Do we start with who deserved to win? Do we start with that substitution that led to arguably the worst decision probably ever made? Or do we start with a manager who clearly likes to make things way more complicated than they actually need to be? Take your pick.
I'm going to throw the cat amongst the pigeons here, because I wouldn't like to start with any of those. I think there's one thing that we have to start with that I think we actually spoke about this either last week's podcast or the podcast before. And we criticised Tuchel, well, I certainly did collectively, saying £85 million or £80 million on Kai Havertz, not getting the best out of him. Here we are 2 weeks later. Kai Havertz is arguably the most informed Chelsea player at the moment. Granted, it's only two or three games, but there's no doubt about it. He's been the most influential Chelsea player in that team up front. He's playing that false centre-forward role. Now, the question I have for you is, if he's playing false centre-forward role and he's playing like he is, where on earth does that leave Romelu Lukaku going forward? He didn't get in the Champions League game. He couldn't get in the cup final. Where on earth does that leave him?
I don't know. I mean, Lukaku's a bit of a strange one. We've spoken about him quite a lot, so I don't really know where it leaves him. I don't think Lukaku knows where it leaves him. I'm not convinced by Chelsea full stop. Mind you, they gave it more of a go than I thought. I mean, how Mason Mount hadn't scored those two chances, I do not know. At one point, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, to be honest, because I thought Chelsea could have had it dead and buried by half-time almost. It struck me as a tale of two halves. First half seemed to be Chelsea's, and then we need to... I mean, it's a tale of two goalkeepers as well, because have you ever seen a double save like it?
Unbelievable.
From Mendy. I mean...
ridiculous. But when a keeper is making those two absolutely ridiculous saves, and then you take him off for like the most crucial part of the game, it's just like, for goodness sake, that guy's confidence is going to be sky high. He's just won, obviously, the African Cup of Nations, and he saved, like, you know, he was the bloody penalty shootout to goalkeeper then. You just think, what the hell are you doing? So, yeah, let's talk about this now. But when a keeper is, those saves he made during that game, it's like, for goodness sake, why would you then take him off to someone who weighs like about 6 stone and looked like a, like, you know, me in goal, but in like a skinny version, and I can't even touch the crossbar?
I'm glad you brought this up, right? Because the one thing I never get with this decision with managers that do it is, and I know a couple of managers have done it and it works and it looks genius at the time, but let's face it, it only looks genius if it works. And the difference between if it works or not isn't down to skill. It's down to pure luck and lottery, right? So you can't, as a manager, you can't sit there, like, for example, Klopp. If he put Alisson on for the penalties, that's not a stroke of genius. He's just banking on the fact that Alisson is the most experienced goalkeeper out of the two, and he's hoping that he'll be able to nail a save out of one of the 5, 6, or 50 penalties in this instance that ended up being taken yesterday. What I cannot understand is you go into penalties and you pick your best penalty takers, and that is purely based on their confidence normally at the time to take that penalty. As a goalkeeper, you want a goalkeeper in the same context that is going to be confident enough to make the best informed decision. Now, Mendy has been out on the battlefield. Sorry, I probably shouldn't use that as a pun right now. That's terribly timed. Mendy has been out on the field for 2 hours of the game, right? Actually, let's add more context to it. Mendy's just come back off AFCON. He has just won African Cup of Nations. He was jumped straight back into the 11 for the Champions League. And now he's playing in a League Cup final. And he has absolutely had the game of his life in that cup final, namely with that double save, but a fair few other points in the game as well where you thought, unbelievable. Command in his box. He's number one. Right. The thing that baffles me is he's number one every week for Chelsea. They never sub Kepa on for a penalty in a league game, do they? So why would you do it in a cup final? You've got a goalkeeper playing at the top of his level for the whole game, and then you say,
oh, well done, mate. We're just going to sub you off now. Bring on skinny Malinky over here. Get yourself...
I mean... it's a joke. I don't get
I was going to jump in and say, Mendy, the £27 million replacement for Kepa, who cost him 70 plus million quid. So that tells you that this guy, 70 million quid, is not performing. And everyone knows he's pretty shit, let's be honest. And all of a sudden, what's his pedigree? The thing is, when Tim Krul came on for the Netherlands, you thought, you know, Tim Krul has got a history of saving penalties. Everybody knows that. His record is second to none. He's a big presence. He's a complete shithouse. And you can sort of understand that, even if it backfired. Nothing backfired as much as it did yesterday for Chelsea. But the fact that if it was just argument's sake, it was Tim Krul in it and that ended up happening to him, you think, well, fair enough, because he's got such a rich history of it. But as a bit of argue, as you say, like a 6 stone little weedy present, like, you know. So
can we talk about the ultimate shithouse penalty of Virgil van Dijk, who blasted the ball directly where he stood and probably would have carried him through the net if he'd have tried to save it?
And Konate as well. Konate took a penalty. He dived the same way, like the correct way, and it just went through his arm.
Do you think that penalty shootout would have reached 11 if Chelsea and Liverpool had Alisson and Mendy in goal?
No.
It wouldn't, would it?
No,
of course it wouldn't. To be fair, I respect Klopp hugely for going for Kelleher because obviously he'd played the whole cup. He'd obviously had a word with him in private saying, you're my cup goalkeeper. And to be honest, he is a very good goalkeeper. I know he's number two. He's never going to get anywhere near Alisson, but he's a very good goalkeeper. Without, you know, he's not a huge presence in goal for penalty shoots that you thought, well, come on, at least Provolar a little bit and like move around a little bit. He looked a little bit intimidated. However, when he stepped up and scored that penalty, you think, bloody hell, like this kid, he knows what he's doing. And I've got a huge respect for Klopp for really going for his guns rather than doing what he could have easily said and said, like, right, do you know what, Alisson, you jump on, you've got better chance than Kelleher has. So fair play to Klopp.
What Chelsea did, however, for me, is just, it blows my mind. And you do wonder what that makes Mendy feel. You basically, let's be honest, the message to Mendy is there, you're not as good as Kepa for a penalty shootout. That's what he's told him.
Even though you have just come back from AFCON where you were
winning a penalty shootout.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
It's interesting with the whole Kepa thing because I don't think Chelsea expected Mendy to have quite the impact he had at Chelsea. I'll be honest. And I thought the signing of him from, I think it was Rene, wasn't it? He came from in France. I don't think they ever envisaged he's their £80 million golden boy. And they needed to bring someone in to say, look, you need to kick up the arse. And I think it's backfired slightly because Mendy's come in and he's been brilliant. And part of me thinks that actually the whole Kepa penalty thing yesterday, that wasn't tactical. Because if you're a manager worth your salt, Klopp stuck to his guns and stuck with Kelleher, which takes balls in a cup final because that's a trophy you're basically, you know, you're relying on him to see through a high pressure game. And fair play to him. He did that. He did that brilliantly. So Klopp stuck to his tactics. Now, Mendy has been a constant throughout that Chelsea team and he's just come back off the back of winning AFCON and he's experienced a penalty shootout in AFCON and I think he saved a penalty or two as well at AFCON as well. So for me, it's terribly naive of Tuchel to come out and say that was his tactics and he'll take the blame because it was his decision. Because if I'm the manager of Chelsea in the cup final, knowing that Chelsea haven't won the last five or six domestic cup finals, and I'm at a penalty shootout, and arguably, if that game ended 0-0, Mendy probably would have got man of the match, right? But then when it comes to actually the crunch and penalties, what, he's taken off? For what reason? Bad performance? No. Tactically? No, because tactically in the game, he was the best goalkeeper. He was always called upon and he'd done the right thing. So I think Kepa's just a problem. And I think they basically put him on to, you know, lip service. I think he was there. And I think the setup was, well, we better let him, you know, Mendy's had the game, but Kepa, this is your chance to step up and do the job. Problem is, like with England in the Euros, Southgate was naive and brought Rashford and Sancho on for penalties and thought bringing them in cold would be the best thing to do. The best thing to do in a penalty shootout is if your player's got momentum and is confident, you want them to step up and take and score a penalty. Therefore, if your goalkeeper is confident and has just had a man of the match performance, arguably, you want him in goal because he's going to have big chest puffing out. You know, they lost all of that. Van Dijk looked at Kepa and thought, fuck you.
The one final thing I just wanted to say, and then we'll go on to the final games, is why can't a ref book a goalkeeper after warning him multiple times to get back on his fucking line?
Well, that was Tuchel's genius addition of Kepa to come on and really, really be intimidating, you know, like, because someone like Virgil van Dijk is really going to be intimidated when little Kepa is walking up to him, like to his like fucking shoulders and thinking, you know what, you haven't got a chance against me, mate.
Well, with your baguette arms, mate, you haven't got a chance against me.
I think every single person in the world watching that would think, what the fuck is this little scrawny bastard doing? Seriously.
I'm not saying it. Nothing else is allowed to be said about that game. That needs to finish on that. That finishes on that. Right, let's go down south and get the Friday fixture out of the way. Not a lot to say, I'm sure, Koss.
I'll try and do this in under 2 minutes. It was men against boys. We're missing Ida, who's obviously injured for the rest of the season. Smith has got a partnership between him and Pookie. The service to Pookie was absolutely shambolic. The goal that Southampton scored was a bit of luck. It obviously, like, Gunn saved it. It hit a Norwich player. I think it was Max Ahrens, and it dropped to him. Adams then fell over and then eventually scooped the ball over Gunn. So you could say there's an element of luck there. I think throughout the 90 minutes, Norwich had about an 8 to 10 minute spell where, I must admit, we actually looked all right. We didn't score because we're shit. We didn't create anything because we're shit. And unfortunately, our best player, which is Rosicha at the minute, who I think will be our number one player. However, you can't really talk about that when you're in the bottom of the table and you don't really have a hope in hell of staying up at the minute, the way that we're playing. But for everything good against Liverpool that we did the previous week, we did equally as bad against Southampton. Though their home record is very good, and credit to them, you'd have thought on paper that Norwich would see that as a fixture. Well, we could get a point out of that, and we didn't take our chances in the 8 to 10 minutes that we had of the 90 minutes. And it was wrapped up with a superb goal, that, you know, man of the match performance by
Romeo. What a goal.
Hell of a goal. And that was the icing on the cake for them. But to be honest, I think that was just a sort of, like, that was just a cherry, because the icing was already on the cake, to be honest.
I was quite disappointed, actually, with Norwich in that game, because I actually thought after the Liverpool performance, that was a game.
Same. Southampton 100%. Overs,
but Norwich went to Southampton and basically got walked over. And I think for Dean Smith, even, since he's come in, he's set such a high standard for performance, I think. I don't think that is the first time under Dean Smith, and you probably have a different viewpoint to me, but that is the first time under Dean Smith I've ever seen a team of Norwich's roll over and basically get their bellies tickled.
We've got my favourite team next at home next Saturday. So if we win that, which I think we will, at least we'll be able to drag them into the relegation mix as well, because they deserve it.
Just on that, actually, I was going to say, with regards to Southampton and Norwich's next five games, so Southampton, just to point out, other than West Ham in the FA Cup, which they could win, by the way, and you're into the next round, happy days. It's not out of the question for sure. So Southampton have got Villa, Newcastle, Watford, Burnley, Leeds. So you kind of wonder, again, like, when we talk about Wolves that have got a great game, great run of games, Southampton arguably have. And you've got to say as well, other than Norwich, I mean, the FA Cup seems like a bit of an inconvenience at the moment, but the fact that Norwich then go into, hoping they don't pick up any injuries out of that FA Cup game, Brentford, Leeds, Chelsea at home, probably a lot, but then again, you don't know what Chelsea you're going to get at the moment. Brighton, who are on a downturn, and then a massive game against Burnley at home. Those five games for both teams are massive. Well, let's talk about the other team that are right in the midst of it. I mean, I know me and Cookie had a bit of a wank fest regarding them, but I'm sorry. When you are second to Liverpool in the last five games, being Newcastle United at the moment, you deserve credit as far as I'm concerned. Turned over Brentford with ease. I mean, again, we spoke about a resurgent Joe Linton in midfield, got a goal. Joe Willock's all of a sudden decided that the end of the season is his time to hit form, because he did it last season. Just to put it into context, in five games, Leeds and Brentford have got 1 point, Newcastle 13. That is how quickly in five games those 12 points have opened up. What does that now mean for Newcastle and Brentford?
Brentford are gone. I've said it for a few weeks. Thomas Frank's interviews, he seems to have cracked. He seems to be, we played well, no criticism, blah, blah, blah. I alluded to it a few minutes ago about the whole Premier League experience in the fight for relegation dogfight. They've lost their way. They can't win a game.
The last 11 Premier League games, they've lost 9, drawn 1, won 1.
Yeah.
So yeah. I hate to turn around and say, you know, like, if you can just write it on a postcard saying Costi was right all the time and we shouldn't have prematurely wanked off Brentford for the rest of, you know, for the start of the season. And I don't take any satisfaction because I don't have anything against Brentford, but it did. It was a frustrating that I personally
could see
it from miles away. No, surprisingly,
you sure?
It's only, like I said, it's only because of the media loving they got, everything about Brentford. Oh, it's incredible. A bit like plucky old little Bournemouth, etc. It just got a bit tedious and tiring with the media. And now it's coming to the end.
As for Newcastle, I mean, it's looking good. Where there's a Willock, there's a way.
I'm off.
I mean, seriously, Newcastle, do you honestly think they're staying up? Just in one word?
Yeah, I can't see the any.
That was great.
To, that.
To answer your question, Scott, yes.
Thank you. That's great.
I think they're on target to stay up.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Moving on, we go on to mind you, I won't say irrelevant games. One of them was, but we always will give Jason the opportunity to talk directly to Mr. Seagull Simon. Park up, Jace.
Right, Seagull Simon and the rest of you seaside wankers. I remember not so long ago when I was on my way back home from a Palace game. And I was told that Brighton are going to Europe and Palace are going to get relegated.
Here we are, only 4 or 5 games later. Oh, and guess what? Much to their delight, I'm sure they've got a massive tub of Vaseline jelly ready. We are right up their arse, 3 points behind them. Just the way they like it.
Oh, dear.
We are
Brighton are sinking fast, mate.
They are. This happens every year. They bottle it. They get ahead of us. They get a nosebleed. They've just not got the bottle for it anymore.
I think we might be the one treating Jason to this meal at the end of the season from the looks of it.
Oh, and dear.
He might. If Brighton do finish above Palace, I think his rants to Seagull Sy and all the other Brighton fans. It's worth it. Yeah, I think it's 100%. Worth it. We'll treat you to a meal, mate.
If we can get Palace above Brighton, I think it's going to be worth it. And I might even like give us a 30-minute show dedicated to Jason, directed to Brighton.
I'm just going to, while you lads just speak about the game now, I'm just going to go onto my Twitter feed on the night that I got absolutely rinsed by Brighton fans telling me how they're above us and they're all high and mighty.
Can you directly address each tweet for us?
Oh, yeah.
Please. Thanks. Right. Cossy, what did you make of Brighton Villa and what do you think of Steven Gerrard? And then we'll give Jason 2 minutes to directly address the tweets.
To be honest, I don't think I can concentrate after Jason's addressing of all Brighton fans, you Seagull wankers. I personally don't have a problem with any of them. However, after seeing the Twitter abuse that we do get, I can understand the hatred, really, Jason. However,
Jason's got a chip on his shoulder, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's going to be swooped down and eaten soon, isn't it? But yeah, there's a lot of yellow cards in the game. Villa came out 2-0 winners. That was a bit of a surprise for me because Villa have been on a decline for a little while. However, if you're going to have any result to put yourself back into the mix and make yourself a little bit more relevant again, because obviously we're saying they're not really doing much this season, they're not going to get relegated, they're not going to get to Europe. But it's all about performance for me with Villa, and if Gerrard can start implementing what he wants from the squad, which he did early on, I know it's easy to criticise him because it's like, oh, high and mighty Steven Gerrard coming. You know, obviously I personally always love him, but yes, it's a good win for him, and yeah, poor from Brighton again. Not really much else to say about that, to be honest.
And I'd like to point out the tweet I received of Mind the Gap. Was on the 23rd of January, only 5 league games ago. Huh? Mind the gap, they said. I would just like to remind Brighton fans that since they've been promoted to the Premier League, they have never finished above Palace. They haven't beaten Palace in about 5 years. Graham Potter has never managed to beat, you know, he's not so Harry Potter with the old Palace rivalry because he hasn't worked his magic wand and waved it and fucking beat Palace. So,
if you can see this, Brighton fans.
Can I just point out that wasn't his penis? That was not his penis.
That was two chips.
I mean, let's talk about Neil
Maupay. With a lot of salt on them.
Let's talk about King of the Seaside, Neil Maupay.
So salty.
3 weeks ago, match of the day was or Glenn Murray on BT Sports. Oh,
this team can go to Europe. This team can. They're just missing a centre forward.
Really? Based on what? I can go around playing in the fucking Tesco bag for life looking kit. Honestly.
Anyway.
Maybe the bottom line is they just don't have consent to finish in the top six.
It's a common problem.
Oh, that first bit's staying. I don't care. That's staying in. Anyway, last game. I mean, to be fair, there was a big topic in this game, so maybe we devote that particular incident for the next 5 minutes. Everton are in trouble. We didn't expect much out of the Man City game. Mind you, they seem to make a bit more of it than we thought. But the handball. Worst decision in VAR history?
I'm sick and tired of it. For fuck's sake. I know, like, what was it? Frank Lampard said his three-year-old knows that that's a handball. They've made an official complaint to the Premier League today about the standing of referee. And honestly, it's the standard is just, that's just appalling. I don't believe in the conspiracy theory saying like, oh, the big teams get this, the big teams get that. But when you look at that, you just think, hang on a minute, these people on Twitter have a point because that's a fucking ridiculous decision.
The whole T-shirt line rule, which I think is absurd, it's handball, it's handball. None of this T-shirt line bollocks. You know, how do you... A kit's going to be made for standard lengths now so that refs going to judge where it comes in. It's ridiculous.
We're going to start wearing vests soon. If you look at Adama Traore's T-shirt line, that would be a lot higher than most because of his arms at the size of, like, you know, like the size of melons. But honestly, like, it's just boring, isn't it? It's like, I don't want it to get to the point where if it touches any part of your arm, it's going to be handball because that becomes a little bit tedious. Because if it's one of those ones that you really can't do anything about, that it's like you're zooming in about 50-fold, like to make sure, was it his T-shirt that he touched? Oh, his T-shirt's quite tight because, I don't know, Kappa make it rather than like, you know, Adidas. So like, oh, that's going to be how, I can't be bothered for the whole, if it touches your arm, but it's going to get to the point where if it touches any part of your arm. But if that's the case already with the T-shirt mark, well, it was his forearm. It's not even debatable. It's pathetic. The only person that didn't think that was a penalty was the moron on VAR. Fuck VAR.
It was a joke. It's an absolute joke. Like,
he controlled the ball. It wasn't like it was powering at about 1,000 miles an hour from like a yard away, which you can sort of argue saying, oh, he couldn't really do much about that. He was running towards the ball. He was watching it the whole time, put his arm out to control it, to give him the advantage to save it from a corner or whatever it would have been. It is pathetic. It's just like boring.
It's not looking great for Everton, but even we can agree they didn't deserve that. Just for footballing reasons, they didn't deserve that. So, yeah, I think Lampard had a point, but, you know, again, though, without going any further with it, City not looking really, you know, that dangerous up top, causing themselves problems. And it's a really, really odd turn of events for Man City recently. But at the end of the day, they've got 3 points there. But certainly there's big questions to be asked as to whether it's City winning the games or the officiating. But I don't want to be too controversial. Anyway, we have covered all the games. So we go on to predictions for next week. I already have Cookie's game, so I'm going to throw that one out there. He's gone for quite a big mid-table clash. He's gone for Aston Villa Southampton as his prediction. So, I will open the line up for you boys, whoever wants to take it.
Desmond, please. 2-2.
2-2, eh?
3-2, Villa.
Interesting. Cookies also said Villa will win. He said 2-1. I'm going to go the other way round. I'm going to say a 2-1 win for Southampton. Ooh. On that one. I don't have as much faith in Gerrard as you boys seem to. Whereas Southampton, looking like my team of the season. My game's next, simply because you two had the picks last week. I have gone for the big one. Norwich-Brentford. And I feel like there's a spanner about to be thrown into the works here. I'm going to say a Norwich 2-1 win, mate.
You feeling okay?
Just about. I have given a penalty to Brentford.
Yeah, but that's the only way they'll score it. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not edit that out. You know, I'll be eating my words. However, I do feel a Norwich win on this, and I'm going to. I was going to go 2-1 myself, but I'm going to go even braver and go 2-0 to Norwich, just to be different.
Cookie went 1-1.
That's because he's a dick.
He wouldn't be Cookie if he wasn't, and he'd say it himself. Jace?
I'm going to go 3-1 Norwich. I think this will make or break. I think Thomas Frank's job is on the line in this game.
Bielsa to Brentford, anyone?
I think Bielsa's done. He's left his mark on the Premier League now.
I want to see his bucket and his translator.
Be respectful to the king of the Premier League, will you?
Sorry.
I'm going to go for Newcastle-Brighton.
Wonder why.
How many are Brighton going to win by?
Oh, they're not. They're not. They're going to get their arses handed to them. I think Newcastle win 3-1.
Cookie says 2-0 Newcastle.
That's where I was about to go as well.
I'll be a bit boring. And I, just because I'd be surprised. I'm not saying that I don't think it will happen. But I'd be surprised if this rut went on for that long with Brighton. So I just wonder whether there might be that little steady ship. And I also just be very surprised to see Newcastle go on this many winning run. So I'm going to go 1-1 in that game. And Cossie, your final pick.
I'm going to go Burnley-Chelsea. And I'm going to say 1-1.
Third is on, if that happens. I'll tell you what, if that happens, then there's big problems. I'm going to say 2-1 Chelsea on that one.
I'm going to go 2-1 Burnley.
Controversial.
I've just got a funny feeling that they'll nick something.
I'd be very surprised if Chelsea drop points there. I know Burnley are on a bit of a run, but bloody hell, I mean, where does the buck stop? Kind of my reasoning for Newcastle. I'd just be very surprised. Everyone seems to have a thing that Burnley might do something here, whether he's thinking with his heart rather than his head, but he's gone for 1-1. Interesting. Okay, and finally, throw a spanner in the works. Who's up or down? You can move two.
I can move two, Jesus. My God. Let's have a look here.
Well, at the minute, I've got Newcastle bottom, so I'm just going to put them up two places, which would put Norwich 20th, Watford 19th, and then Newcastle 18th, obviously.
I've got Palace 15th, so I'm going to move them up two, and they'll go above Leeds and Everton into 13th, which seems to have my bottom of the table looking quite good now.
I've got Brentford actually in 15th, so I'm going to move them down two to 17th.
What I'm going to do with this is we are on, what, fixture 27, let's say, right? We have a month to get our table as near to what we think it will be, and then it will be locked. And at the end of the season, with predictions total tallied up, we will then get extra points for every correct position you have a team in that table. So it could be the big difference maker, and not having the final eight games to tinker with it means that there's a bit of thought going into it rather than going all the way to the last game of the season.
I better start putting Brentford further down, because obviously I started in November, so I used the current table in November. So I need to start.
Oh yeah, that had
Brentford
you harsh,
down.
Didn't it? All done, boys. Happy days. Can you believe episode 40 next week?
Oh, wow.
We've got FA Cup in midweek. and then a big load of games at the weekend. And then we've got, I think, Burnley Leicester tomorrow night as well. Is that right?
Yes, we have.
Yes. So, yeah, big game for Burnley, that one. One they can definitely win, for sure. But no, FA Cup will be an interesting one. So, again, I guess it is kind of a double game week next week for the four of us, but maybe we'll do it again in a certain way in which we can all tick it off. So, on that note, that is all from me. Cossy, anything before you go?
West Brom lost again tonight, 2-0 at home to Swansea. So, Steve Bruce is working his magic there again, and Andy Carroll might as well be on Ascot running the Grand National.
Jace, anything from you?
I would just like to point out, as pointless as Bielsa's managerial career is, I'm going to end with a pointless stat about him, and that is that the last three clubs he has managed all begin with the letter L. You are welcome, Leeds fans. Toast yourself your lagers to that, because that's as pointless as Bielsa's career has ever been.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And on that note, we are going to end the show in tribute to the best there is, best there was, best there ever will be. Marcelo Bielsa.
Thank you for listening to Total Football Debate podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It would mean the world to us if you could spread the word regarding our show and leave us a rating so we know how we're doing. Also, please, please, please interact with us on social media, especially on Twitter at TF Debate, where we'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on any of the topics we discuss each week. You never know, we may even get you on the show to say hello. Thanks again for listening. And keep an ear out for the next episode.